Thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast, the podcast for people who love wine. I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Welcome to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast. On these episodes, I sit down with one person in the wine industry, share a glass, and discuss the hows, wheres, whats, and whys of how they fell in love with wine. I have renamed this series The Allure of the Pour, since we all love the sound that wine makes as it fills our glass with anticipation. Today, I sit down with Michael Marr, Master Sommelier. A few years ago, thanks to the Wine Education Program Wine Studio, I was introduced to Albarino and the wines of Reyes Vichas. In all honesty, it was love at first sip, and I have become an advocate for the region, talking about it to anyone who will listen. Earlier this month, I was invited to the masterclass on the Reyes Vichas hosted by Gregory and Vine. Unfortunately, I was unable to attend. But thankfully, Stephanie Schwab was able to arrange this one-on-one for me. She is by far the best. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. If you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star review and tell us what you love about the podcast. Each review helps others find us. We truly do appreciate your support. And please follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can also find the video version of this interview on Dracena Wines' YouTube channel. And if you're interested in wine pairings, follow my other blog, Wine Pairing with Dracena Wines, and don't forget about my free wine education series, Wine for Bet Street. Sláinte! Hey everybody, welcome to Exploring the Wine Glass, sponsored by Dracena Wines. I'm your host, Lori, a UC Davis winemaking and WSET Level 2 graduate, and today on Allure of the Pour, I am sitting down with Michael Marr. So thank you, Michael, for coming and joining me on Allure of the Pour.
My pleasure, Lori. Thanks for having me today.
Okay. So we were kind of introduced through the fact that you were doing a masterclass on Reyes Vichas, which is one of my all-time favorite wine regions. Not that I've had the pleasure of actually physically being there, but I just love the wines. There's so much about the region that I love. And I was unable to attend your class, but luckily we got to be together so I can drill you with a whole bunch of questions.
Absolutely. I'm sure a lot of people get shy in large crowds, so the questions generally go unanswered. Hopefully they get answered throughout the presentation, but kind of a nice format to be able to sit down and be a little bit more focused and on topic.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So I wanted to start off a little bit about yourself because I joke all the time that, you know, I have to stalk people who I'm interviewing, you know, but I mean, holy, like, wow, your background is so impressive. You are actually one of only 262 Master Somms. So congratulations. That is a huge, huge achievement. But I want to know a little bit about your backstory. How did you get into wine, and how did you find your way into that Master Somm program?
Yeah, so kind of my journey has been long and winding and not always linear, it seemed like at some point. I did my undergraduate degree at Harvard University, and I went from economics to sociology, and having a sociology degree doesn't exactly set you up for a career path down the road. There's going to be more school required no matter what. So I decided after graduating from Harvard to go to culinary school, which, again, seems perfectly logical for nobody. So I went to culinary school. I wanted to be a chef. Spent 2 years at the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. It was a wonderful experience. Came back to Boston and worked in some great kitchens. And after time in the kitchen, I realized that it didn't quite I loved the industry, but cooking professionally wasn't satisfying this kind of academic brain that I had developed over time. So I decided at that point to move to Australia, which, again, seems perfectly reasonable. I found a master's degree program in gastronomy, which is the study of food and wine, the history and culture a lot of people like, oh, you're going to go become a doctor, because they didn't understand what gastronomy means. It sounds kind of medically related. And I said, nope, yes, I'm becoming a doctor. Sure, that's the easiest explanation. Moved to Australia, lived in Adelaide for a year, which was incredible. Fantastic people, great food, great wine. But then I got kicked out of the country because my student visa was expiring, and they said, you have to go now. But it was a great year. And I came back to Boston and got into restaurants, got back into restaurants, but in the front of the house. And wine was always a hobby of mine. It's something I enjoyed. It was in my family. They enjoyed wine. It wasn't a mystery. I was scared a little bit that wine was going, like getting into wine profession was going to ruin my love of wine, like kind of cooking professionally tainted my love of cooking. But I got into the front of the house, got into wine as a beverage manager, as a sommelier, had some amazing mentors, and took my first the introductory class for the Quartermaster Sommeliers back in 2006 and passed. And after that, it's like, wow, this is an amazing group of people that know so much about wine. I would love to think that maybe someday I could be like that, that I could be half as knowledgeable as some of these people that are teaching. And just kind of kept learning and taking that education, the book learning, and taking it to the floor of the restaurants that I worked in, and training the staff around me and just being excited about it. That was the cool thing about wine, is the more that I learned, the more I could talk about it at work and get people excited, and the results would show. People would sell more wine. People would get more excited about wine, and just the enthusiasm taken to the table. People love that experience. So that's kind of how it happened. And then, you know, I mean, you never take the introductory class, think you're going to be a master sommelier someday. But, you know, as you kind of progress through the levels and you meet more people who are on the same path and, you know, going through the same journey as you are, you make some great lifelong friends, and the solidarity and community that I built nationwide kind of set me up to advance my career. And, you know, it took me 6 times to pass the master sommelier exam. It was, you know, just as much as about perseverance and kind of my own, you know, psychology as it was knowing about wine, you know, managing nerves and, you know, kind of understanding myself as a test-taking organism that's totally unexpected in just about any other industry you're in, but here's this really unique opportunity, and it was great. I don't look back with any regret whatsoever. The amount of time and money that I spent, you know, some people pass it in a year and they're kind of freaks of nature, but I would never have wanted to go through that so quickly, because I really feel like I've built these rich friendships and experiences over the years, going through the entire process and struggling. And once I did pass, it was an amazing feeling.
So, going back to the psychology of it, I mean, honestly, 6 times, for people who don't know the program, they're probably thinking to myself, oh my God, 6 times. But I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, only 6 times. Like, you know, like, it is a rigorous, very difficult program, and that is shown by only 262 people who have done that. So now I have a question that I've never asked anybody. Do you get a number? Are you number?
I don't know what my number is. When there were fewer master sommeliers in the U.S., you kind of could count what number you were. I'm somewhere around like it's just in the U.S. I don't know if it's globally, but I'm somewhere around like 235 globally and 150 in the U.S., 140 in the U.S. So I don't actually know my number, but I kind of know the ballpark of where I fall. So. I find it to be less important to have that number, and kind of have my class, if you will, my class of 2015, where there were 7 masters that passed. We all passed together out in Aspen, Colorado. So 7's the number that kind of resonates a little bit more in my mind than kind of my pin number, if you will.
Wow. So there were 7 of you in 2015, and all 7 of you passed?
No. There were the pass rate's somewhere around 5%.
Yeah, I know.
In 2015, there were around 140 people that took the test in some fashion. So, and then 7 of us were successful. But it's thought to be the most difficult exam in the world. You know, just because of the extremely low pass rate. I mean, the pass rate is, you know, it's lower than the acceptance rate to Harvard, which I think is around 8 or 7% now, which again is mind blowing. But it's much about perseverance and about understanding yourself and having 3 good days, one for tasting, one for service, one for theory, having all of your, basically having confidence on each day, knowing what you know, and then being able to perform. There's a lot of anxiety and stress that goes into it, and that has derailed me for a number of years. It's derailed some amazing professionals in this industry. There are some like superb sommeliers out there in the world who aren't masters by certification, but in my mind are masters because of how they, I mean, just their professionalism. So while it's a wonderful title to have, it doesn't mean that there aren't other amazing people out there in the world. And I think people should know that. They should know both sides of it. It's not the be all end all, but it's played a pretty significant role in my life.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't know if this is politically correct to ask or not, but how do you feel about the fact that, I mean, on one side, you must be so proud that you're part of that 5%, but on the other side of it, do you think that that test is a bit too rigorous and too hard that maybe they should, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a fair question. People have asked me that before. It's like, well, it's, why does it have to be so hard? And the reason why is because it's the master sommelier exam. You have to have a mastery of information across wine, across spirits, across alcoholic beverages, about service, about tasting. It's not the really good sommelier exam. It's the master sommelier exam. And there's a standard internationally that they put forward. And it's, here's the bar. And it's who can get over the bar. And I think Shane Bjornholm, who's the examination director for us here in the United States, has done a magnificent job of keeping that bar really consistent, at a consistent level where he sets it there and the exam committee goes over the test. And it's like, it's amazing how consistent 5% pass. Maybe not every year, but you look at a 10-year span and it's right about 5%. And that's just how it's borne out over the years. Do we want more master sommeliers? Absolutely. I mean, that's the whole point of our organization, is to create more master sommeliers. That's why we have the programming we have, the examinations we have, the courses we have, the mentorship that we all put in, is so there are more master sommeliers. We want more people to be seen as masters in the industry, and professional, kind of people that other people just in the industry can look up to. We want more. But at the same time, we don't want to give it out if it hasn't been earned. So it's definitely a balancing act, and certainly it pulls both ways. When you do earn it, you've definitely gotten that standard, and there's really no question. No one becomes a master by accident.
Right, absolutely. And I guess of those 262 people, they also don't want it to go from that 5% to like 50%, because then that kind of dumbs down your accomplishment. So,
yeah. And plus, you had people that passed back in the 1980s that, had lack of, I mean, there's no internet. The books, as soon as they were published, went obsolete. I mean, the sourcing of information was more difficult. And so now it's like we have more resources available, but, it's a matter of kind of standardizing it over time. Mm-hmm. Back in the 1980s, sure, the wine world was smaller. Now in 2019, the wine world is huge, but we have more access to it. We have more access to winemakers and Skype and all sorts of connectivity. That, should the test be easier, or should the test kind of reflect our ability to get more information and people can dig deeper? And again, it's understanding what mastery means on a really almost a daily basis, and trying to put forward the standards that reflects that.
Wonderful. So let's go back to Australia, because, I think I'm kind of fly by the night. Everybody's like, oh my God, you're going, they joke. My husband jokes all the time with me. He's like squirrel. And I'm, I'm off on a new thing. So I'm that type of person who would go here, go there on this, but what made you just pick Australia?
Well, there was, so I was looking for a master's degree program and something that tied in with the decision that I made to go to culinary school. My passion for food and wine, and there were very few options for that back in the day. I mean, I could have gone to Cornell to get a master's in hospitality. I think that was running about $70,000 for the master's program. I could have gone to Italy, but I did not speak Italian. I still do not speak Italian. So that would have been a challenge culturally. There was a program in Boston. I lived about 20 minutes from Boston. I'm like, yawn, I can go to school in Boston. Or I found this program in Australia, which was the opposite side of the planet. And the Australian dollar versus the American dollar was, it was very favorable. I think it was like 60 American cents bought one Australian dollar. So I looked at the price. It wound up being like $18,000 for a master's degree.
Ding, ding, ding.
That's a good deal. And then I got an apartment in Adelaide, downtown Adelaide, for like $500 a month. So it was amazing to just go live in this foreign country where you could argue they speak English. I will argue it's not really that close. You got to learn the dialect. You got to learn what you can and can't say. You got to drive on the other side of the road. It was a total cultural immersion, and it was great. The one thing I didn't really realize getting into it was how far away it was. I felt like I was on a plane for weeks. And it's like finally landed. Like I do feel like I'm on the opposite side of the planet now. I felt as far away from home as I ever did. But it was, again, a fantastic experience. I encourage anybody to visit Australia. It's a wonderful country, great food, great wine, great people. But be prepared. It's going to take you a while to get there. So maybe stop in Hawaii or something.
Yeah. It is a multiple Ambien trip, right?
But just don't walk around the airplane trying to, like, you know, cook things up, because I know Ambien tends to get some sleepwalkers.
But so at that point, you were definitely more food focused than wine focused.
Yeah. So that was kind of like my turning point. Australia was when I went the switch flip from food to wine. I wrote my master's thesis on screw cap wines. Oh. And how, like, in the U.S., this was back in 2005. In the U.S., it wasn't so much the public that was rejecting them. It was the gatekeepers. It was sommeliers and winemakers. Technology wasn't in the winery. Sommeliers didn't want to be misunderstood when they went over to a table and cracked the bottle. There's something romantic about, you know, taking the foil off and taking the cork out and pouring the wine. The screw cap, they felt kind of cheapened that. It cheapened their duties in the restaurant. Now, I think it's totally commonplace, and a lot of times these buy-the-glass programs are determined based on whether or not they can open the bottle quickly and get a bartender to pour you a glass of wine, you know, in 5 seconds. So it's really changed the whole rubric of wine service and wine sales. So again, it's a different place we are, you know, 15 years past that. So again, it was wonderful because it tied in the academic, the food, the wine. So it all made sense after that. It's like, oh, this is where I'm supposed, this is how I was supposed to go on my journey.
So while you were there learning about food, I mean, in Adelaide, it's obviously wine, at least today it is. And back then, I think there was less of it, but it still was in the forefront, right, of the...
Adelaide, you know, has been the capital of the Australian wine industry for decades. You know, it's 54% of all the wine in Australia comes out of South Australia. When I was there, it was just as important to the wine industry as it is today. I went up to the Barossa Valley. I went down to McLaren Vale. You had huge companies, working through the port of Adelaide, shipping, you know, getting, you know, and so, I mean, it was there. It's hard not to be, you know, kind of involved in wine, or at least acknowledge the fact that wine played a really large part in that city's vibrancy. Okay.
Again, another place I've never been, although I keep hoarding all of my miles, everybody's like, well, why don't you use your miles to fly back and forth to California? And I'm like, because I'm hoarding them for when I go to Australia and New Zealand,
It's not worth using it for California. You can suffer on that plane trip, but yeah, you want to splurge a little bit if you can get one of those nice lay flat beds. That's the way to get there.
Yes, I needed that lie flat bed for Italy, you know, and France. Yeah. Never mind going to the other side over there.
Exactly.
So you must also, like, I mean, so obviously addicted to education. You were saying, you know, you like that education aspect, because in addition to being a master som and having a master's degree from University of Adelaide, you also went through the WSET program for the diploma. You are approaching wine in every which way possible.
People have commented on how much money I probably have spent on my education. I don't like to think about that that much, because it's probably a terrifying number. But I just feel like it's allowed me to get to a point where I have reference points. I'm not I don't have an encyclopedic memory. I can't just rehash facts. So it's like, I feel like I have a good grounding. And you know, the course of Master Sommeliers is all about, kind of performance in a restaurant and service based, where the WSET is more theoretically based. Right. It's more about the winemaking. It's about the what, and the quartermaster sommeliers is more about the how we get to the table and the why. And why does it taste like this? And you think cause and effect. And, so I think they were really complementary. I took, you know, them in parallel back, I guess just, 10 years ago or so when I started out. And I feel like they really were nice, compatible formats, because the WSET is classroom and the court is more self-study. So it really worked out well. I met some amazing people through the WSET. The diploma was, again, it kind of tied in the fact that I was writing papers for my master's degree. And I was like, okay, writing about the business of wine. This isn't too far removed from my world. So, again, it all kind of comes back and makes sense. Am I done with school? I don't know. I kind of joke with my wife that I need to go back to school again. It's been too long. And she just kind of shakes her head and says, well, what on earth are you going to do this time?
Well, that was going to be my question. What's left? You've got the diploma at the WSET. You've got the master's. I mean, is there something I'm missing that I don't know what else there is?
People always ask, like, oh, you're going to do the MW, Master of Wine program. Oh. Or, I don't know. Or it's like the certified wine educator. And I'm like, I don't know. It's one of these, one of these days, maybe I'll just kind of go online and sign up for something, and then 10 minutes later I have instant regret because I'm now buried in books again. But I'm pretty happy right now with where I am, and the flexibility and freedom that I have to kind of study what I want to study, and learn about regions that really are interesting to me, as opposed to being like, okay, now it's back to really regimented, here's what you got to learn, here's what you got to own. It's certainly a lot of fun right now. But again, who knows? Down the road, something may catch my fancy, and back to the academic rigors again.
How about going from the other side? So we're, my husband and I own the winery. We're the winemakers there. I went through the WSET to see the other side of it. I know all the chemistry, the biology, the making of a wine, what it's like to be in harvest, all of that. But I didn't know the other side of it. So I went that way. So maybe that's where you can, delve into.
I thought about, again, I don't know if I can go take an organic chemistry class at this point in my life. I've heard horror stories, but maybe going and spending a harvest at a winery and just kind of, immersing myself in that. And, being in Massachusetts, there aren't a lot of wineries around where I can go kind of learn that kind of thing. But, again, there's lots of options out there, and there's lots of stuff to do and keep myself busy. I could put that on my to-do list.
There you go.
It keeps me getting longer by the day as opposed to shorter. I don't feel like I'm doing enough sometimes, but that's enough. I can't worry about that.
Well, we might have a few connections if you're, interested in going that route.
I'll certainly drop you a line, that's for sure.
Okay. Now, and I know we're here to talk about Reaspacious, but I have to go one more of my blow my mind about you yourself. You also have won awards. You were the third top somm 2 years in a row, winner of the national finals for the best young sommelier, and play second at the best young sommelier in the world. I mean, you are like an idol, like we're not worthy type thing. Oh my gosh.
It's funny to think of myself once upon a time being a young sommelier. those were the days. I mean, competition, like there was a competition circuit, if you will. I mean, they were fantastically fun. And this was part of the network of friends that I built up over the years. You'd go and you'd spend a day basically going through similar tasks and that you would at the Master Sommelier exam or the Advanced Sommelier exam. But you'd be doing it instead of trying to get over a bar, you'd be doing it to try to beat everyone else that was there. So there's just, I mean, there's very, you can't really compete against, your colleagues. You all have individual wine programs and different palate preferences. And so you hang out and you drink wine together, and it's very, there's a lot of camaraderie. So this was so different that, like, we're just competing against each other. It's like, but at the same time, it's not like you're competing head to head. It's you're just doing your thing and they're doing their thing. And at the end of the day, you go have a beer and, and you have a good time. And it was a lot of fun. I got to visit Spain when I went to compete at the international level. I went out to California a couple of times for those competitions. So, I mean, it's an opportunity to travel. It's an opportunity to network. There's still some opportunities like that out there. And I encourage anyone who's, again, if it's a young sommelier, I think it's under the age of 30, but
okay,
just participate in these things. Just see what's out there. There's a lot of really cool opportunities to network and travel.
Cool. All right. So let's get down to Rias Baixas. I told you off mic, but when I first found out about the region, it was actually through Tina More in Wine Studio. I don't know if you're familiar with her or not, but it's an online education program. And what they did was each month she would have a theme of whatever, and the wines would come to you. And every Tuesday night, I think it was, we would sit down with a virtual chat and we would be talking to the wineries or to whatever the theme was. And it was a 4-week program. And I had learned so much about different regions because of Wine Studio. And one of the first ones I did was Rias Baixas. And I was like, I can't even pronounce this thing. I have no idea where it is. I have zero knowledge about it. So I had to come up with, those stupid ways of remembering it. So it's Bite Reese's Peanut Butter Cups is how I get that in there. But as soon as I saw the images of how green it is and how just luscious the whole area is, I kind of sort of fell in love. It reminded me of Ireland. So that was, point number one for them. But then as soon as I tasted the Albarinos, I was in love. The salinity, the crispness, everything about that. I have to ask you, do you remember your first experience with Rias Baixas?
I don't remember the first Albarino I ever had. That's a hard thing to try to, think back and reminisce about it. I'm getting a little bit of feedback on the video right now.
Yeah, a little bit. You're a little blurry at the point, but.
Okay, is that any better?
Yeah, actually it is, yes.
Okay, perfect. So the first, I don't remember my first album. I remember going through the court and learning that Albarino was a classic grape variety from a classic region. And so, of course, my studies had to learn more about it. But, just starting to understand it and try to, identify what is it, where is it from, how do I identify it blind in a glass, it was all great. And I, read books about it and saw pictures. But where it really started to make sense was actually last year when I was fortunate enough to visit the region. And all of a sudden, it's like, this is amazing. This is an amazing corner of the world that the pictures don't do it justice. The stories don't do it justice. It really is one of those hidden gems. And even the kind of Spaniards, kind of have allowed it to be isolated. It's almost like its own country at this point. It's just culturally different than the rest of Spain. Geologically, it's different than the rest of Spain. Climate-wise, it's different from the rest of Spain. I mean, it really is its own unique place in the world. And, just to taste the wines, and that's based on one grape variety, it has this international reputation, but yet, in terms of volume, it's pretty darn small. It's smaller than Chablis. It's smaller than, I'm pretty sure it's smaller than Napa Valley in terms of production. But yet it carries this weight around the world of a classic style. And there's, again, as you mentioned, this freshness. There's this this kind of richness of fruit. There's this salinity. There's this that you can use yeast to get more autolytic and kind of, again, have more bready, toasty notes in the wine. I mean, there really is this wonderful kind of playground for the winemakers to create really unique styles of wine purely based upon one grape variety in a really small region. And they encourage us experimentation. There's really this community that encourages a little bit more kind of diversity in wine styles. It encourages people, because the way Rias Baixas is, it's so fractionalized. We think of winemakers, you have to have, here's my winery, here are my vineyards off to the side, here you look out over acres and acres of vineyards. And it's not like that in Rias Baixas. Like, here's the winery, and they might be working with 50 or 60 different growers, each of whom has maybe an acre or two of land. So you really have, you know, this kind of home base, this wine, you know, winemaker, winery that's dealing with 50 or 60 different entities, different plots, different vineyards, different, you know, some people are more involved in the grape growing than others. Some are weekend warriors. Some are, you know, they retire and they do it full time. Some people are just doing it because it's been their generation or in their family for generations. So it really is about every, you know, making sure everyone kind of adheres to a certain standard and keeping everybody honest. You know, no one wants to be excluded from the harvest because their grapes weren't good enough. And if they do, then their neighbors are there helping them out, not being like, oh, you didn't do the right thing. We can't talk to you. It's like, let's help you get back on board next year. There's really this, again, this sense of community. And I think it's because of that isolation, because of the unique cultural influences in the area, that people just come together rather than push apart. And that's this is powerful stuff that you don't learn from books, but you learn by going and talking to winemakers and talking to people who live there, eating the food, dining at their tables, just being a part of, again, kind of the environment. And all of a sudden you feel like this is a really amazing region that, you know, each region has its own signature, but this is really something unique that I experienced that I didn't see in a lot of other regions in my travels over the years. Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about this region makes it this DO that is dedicated to Albarino only, basically? What makes that region so special that Albarino is it there?
Yeah, I mean, where it's located, I mean, it is essentially right on the Atlantic coast. It's right on that the northwest coast of Spain. So it is continually buffeted by sea breezes and fog and moisture, and Albarino has proven itself over the years to do okay in this environment. It's been in the region. They will claim that it's an indigenous grape variety. It's been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. But speculation is maybe it came from France, maybe it came from Germany, maybe it is indigenous. But it's something that has had plenty of time to evolve and adapt. Fortunately, it hadn't had to do that in a global commercial scale. It's been able to do it in more of a small scale for farming. So, you know, it wasn't about making as much wine as possible. It was making wine that the land gave you. And Albarino is perfect for this because, you know, they've just found out that it's fairly resistant to rot. It does well in this cool climate where it retains acidity but still gets ripeness. And other grapes just wouldn't survive, wouldn't thrive here. Maybe they've been a little stubborn over the years. Maybe something else could have taken its place, but didn't, because they love the local flavor that Albarino brings. And you look globally, who else has had this kind of success? Nobody. No one has really done Albarino on a level that Rias Baixas has. And that's another big thing, is once you find something that makes you unique in the world and you are good at it,
Stick to it.
You should probably stick to it, because you don't want to enter into a bigger pond with bigger fish that you're trying to compete against for essentially table scraps. So I think they found a really good niche. Right. And their wines are spectacular with the seafood in there. It's just part of their culture. They basically pull seafood right out of the ocean, put it on the table, cook it simply, and this wine shines with it. It really works well. So it's a perfect match. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Mm-hmm. There's nothing broken up in Rias Baixas.
Looking to be in the know about Dracena wines? Want to know when we release our new wines? Find out about all of our accolades and get some behind-the-scenes information? Well, all you need to do is sign up for our newsletter. There is no commitment necessary, and I promise you we won't spam your mailbox with loads of messages. Need another reason to sign up? Quite possibly the best reason? You will immediately get a code for a special discount on all of our wines and be privy to newsletter-only specials. Let Dracena Wines turn your moments into great memories. Sign up simply by heading to our website, dracenawines.com, and fill out the pop-up or sidebar. It will take less than a minute of your time, but the rewards will last forever. Now, they are specifically, that DO has been created specifically for Albarino. And in fact, at one time, the region was called Albarino. But thanks to 1986, when they entered the European Union, I guess the union laws decided that was too confusing. They didn't want to do that. So that's where Rheas Bicias came into play. So they are still focused, dedicated to Albarino, but in order to claim that on the label, it must be Albarino. But are there other grapes in the area that they can just, you know, make table wine?
Yeah, to adhere to the DO, it has to be a minimum 70% Albarino. And you can use grapes like Lurera and Trechadura. There are red grapes that are allowed to be used in the appellation as well. So, I mean, you have different styles of wine. But, yeah, Albarino is the backbone of classic Rheas Bicias. Even when you see these blends, you have minimum 70% Albarino. So it's great because everyone has that foundation of which to build upon, this successful grape variety. And maybe you have a little bit of a warmer climate, you want to blend in some grapes and maybe retain a little bit more acidity. Or maybe you want something that's a little bit, maybe gives them more of an oxidative quality to your wine. Again, it's common, it's common over there, but for most exports, a lot of the wines that come over to the United States, you know, we like to know what grape it is. And if they can put Albarino on the label, they're going to try to do that. And that means basically going with something that's pure, if not, just, 95% or better Albarino. So they realize that it's as much marketing, even though the DO doesn't allow them to use the word Albarino, they can put it on the label if they adhere to a strict level in their wine.
And you had mentioned that in production wise, they're smaller than Napa or whatever, but in size of actual region, like how big are they?
Yeah, it's not big. You can drive from Condado de Tea or Orozal, which is down the south around the Portuguese border, up to Ribera do Uia, up in the north. Maybe it'll take you about an hour and 15 minutes. So again, it's not huge. There's not a lot of land under acreage, even though it is a kind of a large geographic area. Not all of it falls under one of the subzones. So, it's deceptively small. I don't have the acreage at hand here, but again, you get there and there's a lot of biodiversity. It's not like Napa Valley where it's wall-to-wall vineyard. It's vineyard, and then maybe 5-6 minute drive, and then there's another vineyard, and then there's there are other farms that are interspersed throughout. So really, it's there's a lot of other things going on in this region besides grape growing, which again keeps it really unique. Gives it that personality. When you go wall to wall grapes, it's fairly boring, to be honest.
Right.
But when you see all this architecture and history in the region that is kind of that interrupts these vineyards,
right,
if you will. The vineyards that interrupt culture and history, but again, it gives a bit of a richer experience that people don't quite get when they just drink a bottle. But when they get there and it's a great vacation location, then all of a sudden they're like, wow, there's so much going on here.
Okay, so actually, that was going to be another question I was going to ask you. If people want to visit the area, how receptive are they to visitors? How easy is it for people to visit wineries? Is it appointments? Yeah. Is it, hey, here's my house?
No. It's absolutely, it's worth visiting. A lot of the wineries have websites that do have an English page on it. There's a lot of tourism that happens, not necessarily just within Spain, but also Germans, British. It's a very popular spot for European vacations as well. I mean, kind of that whole Atlantic coast on the Iberian Peninsula is very popular. They would absolutely. It's always recommended to make appointments, just because it's a different culture. They do take a couple hours off in the afternoon. The hours of business are different, so it's always good to line something up so you're not disappointed. But most wineries will absolutely welcome guests. They would love to show you the wine. They'd love the fact that you traveled all this distance. You fly into Madrid, and then it's a quick 1 hour flight up to Vigo, and then it's again maybe half hour, 45 minutes to a whole bunch of wineries you can visit. And then you're not far. No matter what, you're not far from a city where you can have an amazing culinary experience as well for dinner.
Oh, sounds wonderful.
Sounds incredible.
Sounds incredible. Hey, so what really makes Rheas Bicias, at least from what I've read, is that there's the main rivers of Galicia, and I will probably kill how to say them, but the Minho, Sil, Ula, and Lérez.
Mm-hmm.
Am I close?
Absolutely. Yep. That's good. My Spanish is not super, so I'm hesitant to ever correct anybody.
Okay. So these rivers actually flow right into the Atlantic Ocean. Mm-hmm. And yep. As the biologist, I've always loved estuaries. And that's really what is in the heart there of the region. What do you think is the major impact that these estuaries have on how the Albarino is grown and how it's so successful?
Yeah, I mean, just the proximity to the ocean is huge. Again, it's large bodies of water will moderate your climate. It'll keep it more temperate. Maybe it'll give you a longer growing season. There's not a lot of risk of frost here, so you can get sometimes late harvest grapes. The rivers certainly keep air masses moving, so when it does get cold, these rivers will help carry cold air away from vineyards, get that circulation going. Again, it's hard to, I mean, you can't just to get inland. Certainly it becomes a little less impactful, the estuaries. But, I mean, you get the cold water of the Atlantic, you get the warmer water from the rivers, you can get some fog, you can get some humidity in the area, which might present a problem for mold and rot in the vineyard. But the way that the Galicians have combated this in Rías Baixas, they built these pergolas. Maybe 7 feet high, and these giant granite blocks that are 12 inches across into the ground, and then they'll run wires across, and they'll grow the grapes up on these wires. So they're 7 feet above the ground, which will allow that air to flow right through the vineyard, which will help dry out your grape bunches, which will help to, again, get rid of any rot or mold and pests and anything. So they're using nature to help eliminate all those pests and disease vectors. And the downside is when you're harvesting your grapes, you have to look up and your heart above your head. And we got to do this last year, and it's like 20 minutes in, your arms are just ready to fall off. So I've done harvest both bent over when my legs just want to fall off, and now over my head where my arms are just shot and feeling like jelly. So but this is what they've come up with, and it works. And it helps them, again, get consistency in a region that is hugely inconsistent for weather and climate.
So that those pergolas are really cool to see. I mean, I didn't see them live, but in pictures, they're really cool. And it's just genius if you think about it, because I always kind of think, well, how did we get to this point? So they must have originally been growing the vines a certain way, either, head trained or trellising them or whatever. But over the time, they realized that they needed these pergolas. Do you actually see, are there regular trellised vines also?
Yeah, absolutely. When you get down further to the south, in Orozal and Condado de Te, it's a little bit warmer. Okay. You're not getting quite the humidity that you are going to get in Val de Salinas. So you actually will see a lot more traditional viticulture there, a lot more your cordoned vine training system, vertical shoot positioning, things like that. But you get to Val de Salinas, and yeah, there's a lot more of the pergola, just because, again, it's the necessity to combat mold and all that moisture. And the other, I mean, it seems like almost over the top that they're using these giant granite blocks, but there is so much granite up here in Galicia that, I mean, if you ever want to build anything out of granite, go there, because they have it to spare. I mean,
wow.
These houses have been standing for hundreds of years, and they are just the most solid things you've ever seen in your life. And they're beautiful. Mm-hmm. So it's just part of their culture and part of their history, and they've made the most of it. So they have granite posts sticking out of a lot of their vineyards. You're like, this is kind of cool.
Yeah.
You think about how much granite countertop costs, and you're like, these guys just have it.
It's like $1 million right here.
Exactly. It's like, how much is this worth? And you're like, what? It's like the rock. What do we got?
That's awesome. But I do. I wonder what would be better. I'm thinking, I've had back surgery and I've had shoulder reconstructive surgery. So I'm not sure which one I would, prefer to be doing. I think both.
Maybe to like do like 20 minutes of the pergola and then 20 minutes of the traditional kind of head train vine or something like that.
Right.
Like, it's rough work.
Right. Last I read, there were 6,500 wine growers. And as you mentioned earlier on, they all have very small plots, basically like a half an acre, somewhere around there. And you mentioned that they're very supportive of each other to help each other out. But when they're making the wine, are they basically like communes? Are they cooperatives, or is everybody making their own wine?
Some are cooperatives. There are some cooperatives that are in existence. Paco y Lola is one of the cooperatives that are in place where, like, everyone kind of gets a little bit more of a say. But there are wineries that are not cooperative, and they basically contract out with these growers, and they say, here's what we're looking for, here's what we're paying, and if your grapes meet the standards. And, you know, that's how a lot, you know, it's a little bit more of a traditional model, if you will. There's this kind of balance between the two, because you're dealing with so many growers. Some people don't want any input in the making wine. Some people have no idea, don't want to have an idea about how to make wine. So they're very happy just selling their fruit off and just being like, let the people that are in charge of it take care of it. Other people that, you know, are a little bit more involved, and they want to be a part of the process and make decisions about winemaking and packaging and in that kind of, you know, communal effort, if you will. And that's, you know, again, they have avenues for both, depending upon who you are and what your goals are as a grape grower.
Do the wineries there, there's some very large wineries in terms of their region. Are there estate fruit wineries, or are they mostly sourcing their fruit from these vineyard owners?
Just about every winery has to source some fruit. There are some very small wineries that I'm sure could be totally estate driven, but I don't recall any when I was there that were 100% estate driven. I just don't think it's economically possible. And if it is, then you're just not going to have the volume to do anything more than just kind of local or domestic, you know, kind of distribution. So we wouldn't see any over here. Certainly some of the bigger wineries might start working on single vineyards or more isolated parcels as they, you know, kind of expand their global footprint. But it's just not something that they're ultimately concerned about at this point. They just feel like their standard of quality top to bottom is so good that they don't have to put all sorts of kind of frivolous words on their label that, you know, might not mean anything to people that are buying.
Right. And what do you know what the ratio of exported to domestic is?
Yeah. So if my numbers are correct, they produce about 2.5 million cases a year in Rías Baixas, which again sounds like a lot, but that's it for global production. About 31% of that gets exported, which is about 780,000 cases. The U.S. and the U.K. are two of the biggest markets. So, I mean, you think about it, you know, 69% of the wine they produce stays in Spain. They want to drink it. Because it's delicious. but they're looking to expand their markets, their footprints internationally, which is great. The problem is, again, a lot of these wineries are small. They can't tackle the world. Maybe they can go to one country or another. In the United States, they're a really big market. If they come here, they got to have, you know, either the volume or realize that they're not going to get to all 50 states. They got to be a little bit more selective about where they go into in terms of getting their wines on the shelves and into restaurants.
Right. I have to say, I think that over the last like 5-6 years, that Albarino in the United States has really taken off. I think that people are starting to realize, I mean, I don't know how they're doing it for the price they're doing it, but the QPR of these Albarinos that are coming over are just amazing, you know.
And we're starting to see more and more aged wines coming over. That's kind of the next step. And some wineries like Paso de Señorans, Paco y Lola are starting to hold back some library selections. So they're starting to release, you know, 7, 8, 9 year old bottles, you know, that intentionally aged, intentionally made for aging. And they are magnificent wines. You know, when I was there last year, we tasted all the way back to 2002, 2001.
Oh, wow.
And you just never think about Albarino being worthy of aging because we just don't see it. But once you see, you get amazing, you know, the top quality fruit aged on lees for a bit, put into bottle and cellared, and it's wonderful. Wow. I mean, it starts to develop some notes of, you know, like you expect out of Riesling, some for Chardonnay, but yet still has this really floral, lively character that can only be Albarino. So again, they're starting to try to figure out what's next. Sparkling wines are something that have caught
I've had one. I've had one. I don't remember who the producer is, but
they're really good. And it's, there's, again, people want to drink sparkling wine. This is great sparkling wine that doesn't cost a fortune. It's maybe half the price of an entry level champagne. So, do you want? Is it your Saturday night wine? Maybe not. Maybe you could have it on a Tuesday or Wednesday. And that's great because these wines are meant to be drunk and celebrated and had with food. And that's kind of their primary concern. It's not about image or marketing. It's just drink it. Just drink it and enjoy it.
Now, earlier you piqued my interest because you said late harvest. So have you had, I have never seen one, have you had a late harvest Albarino?
I did. It's again, what you'd expect. It's, kind of, it's concentrated, it's luscious, it's, kind of amber in the glass. It's not a big production, but that being said, it is something that they do make. Seeing the global market for sweet wines right now, it's probably not the best economic strategy because that portion of the market seems to be shrinking,
right,
while table wines, white wines, are expanding. So it's a fun thing that you probably will only see when you get there. But they do make them. All absolutely right. Do make them.
Another reason to get on a plane and get there.
That's it.
The DO itself, Rias Baixas, has actually 5 subzones.
Yep.
Okay, so can you give us a little, a little bit brief introduction into each of those regions and like what makes each region so special?
Sure. Yeah. So you kind of have to start with Val de Salnes, which is essentially kind of the heart and soul of the DO. This is where about almost two thirds of the wine comes from. This is where a lot of the big wineries are located. This is, again, without Val de Salnes, you wouldn't have the DO as it is today. This is where a lot of it started. And this has that classic oceanic influence. This is right on the Atlantic. You can stand in some vineyards and you just look right out into the ocean. This is where the patas, the pergolas are. This is where a lot of the, again, kind of the fishing and trade takes place. So it really is kind of the heartbeat of the region. If you go to a little bit further to the north and east, Ribera de Ulla, this is, it's fairly new. It's kind of like, okay, we're getting off the ground. We need some more land that kind of qualifies for the DO. It doesn't quite have the oceanic influence. It still has some of that granite and weathered down soils. But it's a little bit more focused on blending. Mm-hmm. So while you will see quite possibly some Val de Salnes delimited wines, probably Ribera de Ulla, not so much. Turning to the south, the Sotomayor, this is the smallest region. There's not a lot of wine coming out of here, maybe only 5,000 liters or so. And it's, again, more for blending, more for small farmers, more for just kind of bringing more people into the fold. Once it proves itself to be a quality, consistent wine region, we'll see more people probably venture out there. There is a little more land to kind of harvest from. A lot of the wine that is, grapes that are grown there, is not made into wine there. It goes to other wineries in other regions. So again, it's based more for blending and for sourcing wine to go into the DO as a whole. Moving south, the two southern regions, Orozal and Condado de Tea. Orozal being on the Atlantic coast, right on the Minho River. You get a lot more oceanic influence, but because we're further south, you start to see some warmer temperatures. This is where you're going to find a little bit richer style. A little bit more alluvial soils, so a little bit more sandy soils. Not as much humidity, so you won't see the pergola, the potas, as much as you will up in Val de Salnes. But it provides a lot more, this can provide a little bit more texture, a little more richness, maybe a little bit more tropical and orange notes rather than the kind of more sour citrus, a little bit more kind of sharp, crunchy fruit that you'd find up in the northern parts. And then Condado de Tea, a little bit further inland, a little bit warmer. This really becomes a lot more about contours and aspect and kind of where you kind of face on the river. Because, again, you can get really, really ripe fruit here. But you start to get up in elevation as well. So you start to see actually more sunlight, but also greater temperature drop. You're further from the ocean, so you're going to get cooler nights to preserve acidity. So you can get this really interesting balance of ripeness and brisk acidity from Condado de Tea. You also start to see some red wines taking a little bit more of a role here because they can get ripeness from their red grapes, which produce excellent wines, but again, in such a small volume that it's hard for them to get outside the country because, well, if you make great red wine, why would you want to send it anywhere? This is like amazing red wine with seafood too, not just delicious red wine, but perfectly suited for a lot of the local cuisine.
That's awesome. It goes against the, you know, teaching people that you can drink red wine with fish or, you know, basically just drink what goes well.
It adheres to the maxim of what grows together goes together. So it's there are different ways you can, you know, you can make any statistic or any rule work as long as you have the right perspective.
Right. That's the most beautiful thing about statistics, and that's what I kept saying throughout all of when I was forced to learn statistics in college and undergrad and grad. I'm like, I can make this say whatever I want it to say. That's statistics.
Perfect, we have that.
Absolutely. Now, one of the things that I absolutely love about the DO is that over 50%, are women winemakers, and that is like abnormal for for us.
Absolutely.
And I love that. So can you just talk about like what you think, why is that so, and you know, why aren't more regions embracing us?
I think this is again, it comes to the fact that Galicia has been kind of so isolated from the rest of Spain. And again, you know, it's almost a different world. And the Irish influence is very much a matriarchal society up there. I mean, women are, I mean, absolutely, you know, there's equality. And it's about how are you contributing to society? How are you contributing to the family? How are you? It's not about what gender are you. It's like, what are you bringing to the table? And the women up here work hard. And not to say that women around the world don't work hard, but, you know, these women, we were there, they're mariscadores. These are fisherwomen that go out and they are getting razor clams and they're out there every day. You know, whether it's winter, spring, summer, or fall, they are out there. This is like, it's almost kind of like a social club sometimes. There's like 400 some odd women that go out there and you just see them with their buckets and their rakes and their little carts and they'll come back and they'll, hundreds of dollars worth of shellfish, which then they go to buy food for the family to, again, they're just involved in everything. So it makes sense. And this is culturally how it's always been. The women have always been involved in society and very actively so. So winemaking is part of their society. So the women have found roles there. They've gone to school to learn about winemaking. They've taken positions where they're in charge. And it's just the way the culture is. I love it because it doesn't matter who you are, it just matters how good you are at what you do. And I think, again, I wish more regions around the world embraced this meritocracy, regardless of gender, because there's nothing inherent about winemaking that says you must be male or female to do it. Are you good at it? Are you interested in it? Great. A lot of other cultures, they pass it down from generation to generation. It's the firstborn son that gets the inheritance. Here, it's split amongst the family. So it, you know, if you're a daughter, congratulations, you just received a vineyard. You're a daughter, you received the vineyard and the winery. You know, but there hasn't been this push away from that. It's been an embrace of it. And again, it's just, fantastic winemakers regardless of gender. And it's really cool that it's, again, over half are female. So that's, again, kind of really cool.
It's a beautiful. That's a beautiful statistic.
There's no lie in it now. That's a pure statistic.
All right. So as you mentioned earlier, in order to be labeled as Albarino, it must be 70%. Mm-hmm. But depending on the subzone, there are other white grapes or there is other grapes that can be blended in. I am familiar with Torrontes. And I have had an Albarino that I'm going to destroy how to say it. I have had an Albarino that has a Lurero.
Lurero, yep.
I'm impressed with myself. But I am completely unfamiliar with Trejadora and Cano Blanco.
Yep.
So can you talk about these other grapes?
Yeah, so a lot of these are traditionally blended together. If you head over into Portugal, you'll see actually a lot more blending taking place down there just because of the warmer climate. These grapes tend to do better in drier, warmer areas. So Albarino is much more suited to the kind of the moisture and humidity of the northern parts of Reyes Baixas. But getting down towards the south, you will see these other grapes. Some of them retain acidity, later in the harvest, so that you can balance things out. Some are a little bit more oxidative, or maybe even a little more neutral. So all that ripeness and richness you get with Albarino can be balanced out by maybe a little bit more nuttiness, or just a little bit more kind of focus on acidity without adding a lot more weight to the wine. So this will all depend on where it's grown and what, how it's cropped. So, but these tend to be a little bit lighter in terms of style. Albarino, being 70%, is going to be dominant. So it's kind of like how a chef would use salt and pepper. You want to use a little bit of it and go a long way. And you tweak your blend every year to make sure that it represents kind of the style that is true to Reyes Baixas. So, you won't find too many wines, 100% Lureiro, 100% Trechadura. But when you get to taste them and you kind of see like, oh, this is the building block that would make really a lot of sense with this really ripe style of Albarino. This brings it back into balance a little bit more. So again, it's fun that they get to play around with it, and that it's not just only Albarino. It's, can you make a wine that tastes good? And if you can, great. These are the tools we're going to give you. These are the grapes that you can use. And we want you to have all the success in the world.
Right. Excellent. Because I guess it would be rather difficult to have a DO that you could only have 100%. I mean, I don't know. Is there a DO that is of anything that is must be 100% of anything?
I mean, for Ribera del Duero, it has to be 100% Tempranillo. Or,
okay.
Yeah, so I mean, there are some out there, but you could argue that's a little bit easier to do that because the climate's a little bit more consistent. I mean, you go to Burgundy in France, and it has to be Chardonnay.
I had a dumb moment right there.
It's not, because a lot of times, a single varietal is actually kind of strange when you think about it, because these are farmers. They're trying to hedge their bets. We don't, hundreds of years ago, we didn't have infrared and radar and drones and whatever that we're looking at our vineyards with. It was, can you make a wine every year? And In order to ensure that, you planted different things because they ripened at different points. And if you had frost late and you had a grape that ripened early, then great, you were able to still make wine. If it was warm, then you were able to make more wine because you had another grape come online.
Right.
So it was about hedging your bets. It wasn't necessarily about varietal purity. It was about just, can you make enough wine to survive and to sell? And to actually taste good. So blending is a very common thing. We've just gotten to a point in our wine consuming culture where if it's not a single grape, our brain has a harder time processing it because we tend to identify with brands really well.
Right.
Grapes almost become brands. And so when you blend brands together, it kind of messes with our perception of how the world is supposed to work these days.
Right. And, in the U.S. where we can call it a varietal, even though it is technically a blend.
Right. 75% Cabernet, no problem.
Blend
it with whatever else you want. You can still call it Cabernet, even though it might not even taste anything like a Cabernet.
Correct. Especially depending on what you're blending into it. Yes.
Exactly.
All right. So, is there anything about Reyes Baixas that I didn't ask, that I didn't bring up, that you feel people need to know about this incredible area?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it's really isolated, but it's really not. It's really easy to get to. The best way to understand a wine region is to go visit it. I recommend September because the weather is amazing. When I was there, it was like 85 degrees, 80, 85 during the day, cooled down to like 55 at night, didn't rain a drop. Bring an appetite, trial. When you get there, try everything. Don't ask what it is, just try it. Because again, these are foods they've been eating for hundreds of years. These are dishes that have been, prepared by the same person for 40 years, back in the kitchen. It's such a proud community of who they are. That I think that is, every region is going to be proud, but there is just a sense of we are who we are. It's unlike anyone else in Spain. Our music is different. Our architecture is different. It's the end of the Camino de Santiago de Compostela. So it was the end of the pilgrimage. You were supposed to celebrate with a glass of Albarino and some pulpo, some octopus from the ocean to commemorate your arrival in Santiago. It's so rich in history. It's so rich in culture. The wine almost takes a back seat at some points. You're like, why am I even here? It's for wine. but there's so many other things to do. So go spend a week, and you still will feel like you didn't have enough time. So it's a great place, even though it doesn't carry maybe the cachet of Bordeaux or Burgundy or Napa. I think it's one of those regions you get to, and it kind of changes your entire perspective on the world of wine.
Well, I certainly hope to be able to visit one day. Although I really am, by how much I'm enamored by it, by what I've researched about it, I'm really worried that if I get there, I might not ever want to leave.
That is a problem. There's a lot of jamon and delicious foods to eat, yet it was really hard coming home and going into withdrawal from all that deliciousness.
Excellent. So as I kind of let you know earlier that we always end our episodes of Exploring the Wine Glass with a little game of opposites.
Yep.
No right or wrong answer, just whichever pops into your mind. So
there's always a right answer. There's got to be a right answer.
Which the right answer is whatever comes into your mind first. How's that? Okay. Yeah, definitely, you're going to pass. It's not a 5% pass rate.
Okay,
right. So we're good to go. So I will start off with some non-wine related items, and then we'll go into wine. Okay?
Sounds good.
All right, here we go. Night or day?
Day.
Sunset or sunrise?
Sunrise.
Black or white?
White.
Walk or run?
Run.
Food or drink?
Ooh, drink.
Old world or new world?
Old world.
Sweet or dry?
Dry.
Bubbles or still?
Ugh. Bubbles.
I always like bubbles, then still.
Yeah. Oak. Terrible.
Oak or stainless?
Oak.
Drink now or drink later?
Drink now.
Blend or varietal?
Blend.
Vintage or non-vintage?
Vintage.
Cork or screw cap?
Cork.
Napa or Sonoma?
Sonoma.
Commercial or indigenous?
Indigenous.
Bordeaux or Rhone?
Rhone.
And warm climate or cool climate?
Cool climate.
And see, that's it. That's all there is. Woo!
I'm sure I offended somebody with one of my answers somewhere in there.
Like, you know what?
Man, I'm upset. It's like, but they're all too good.
In our world, I don't think you can say anything anymore without offending somebody. So,
touché.
So I will say the one thing that tends to be a trend, and you did stick to the trend, is those who start off with day stick to sunrise and white. And those who say night stick to sunset and black.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, one of the favorite parts of my day now, because I'm an early riser, I got two young kids.
Oh.
I've seen a lot more sunrises this past year. I mean, not that I haven't seen sunsets, but I pay more attention to sunrises now.
Yeah.
A lot more opportunity with a sunrise than with a sunset.
And well, I try to have my eyelids closed for sunrise, but I can appreciate them. I think they're very beautiful. And, you know, the day job that pays for the winery, unfortunately, makes me get up before sunrise. So I do get to see some sunrises. But I don't know, there's just something about a sunset that...
Again, we had a beautiful one here last night. I'm like, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But, there's something almost sad about a sunset in my mind. That's the close of a day, and, if it's a good day, then that's the close of a good day. If it wasn't a good day, then, you kind of reflect back on it, and the sunrise signifies the fresh start that the new day promises.
Right. A sunrise provides you with what can happen, where the sunset is, oh, my God, that happened.
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking about it. That's
right. All right. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining me and taking the time out of your busy day. to do this with me and to share your passion and my passion for this DO, the Aurea Spices DO. It's, in fact, I think I'm going to celebrate, it's only 3:30 or, 4 o'clock now. So I don't have anything in my glass other than water right now, but I think I'm going to celebrate with an Albarino tonight.
Precious. I'm pretty sure it's, I want to say it's like almost 9 o'clock at night. So they're well into, they're just probably sitting down to have supper now. So it's an appropriate time to raise a glass.
All right. So I will raise an imaginary glass right now to you and to them, but it will be filled in a little bit. So thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure, Laura. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. Until next week, slàinte.